Hello and welcome to our podcast, Baby Baking and Kid Raising, hosted by myself, Eliza Carr, a passionate midwife, new mama and founder of Bump and Bub, as well as my co-host, Dr. Joseph Scorry, an obstetrician, gynecologist and fertility specialist, as well as a dad of three. Together, we will be discussing topics from fertility through to parenthood and everything in between. Each week, we will be joined by inspiring guests who share their own journeys through fertility, pregnancy, birth and parenthood, as well as educational episodes from us, a midwife and an obstetrician. Today, we are sitting down with the beautiful Maddie and Rochelle. These incredible women are a same-sex couple and new parents to the most divine little girl, Macklin. Both frontline workers, a firefighter and a paramedic, as well as some of the kindest people you'll find on the internet. Rochelle and Maddie went through reciprocal IVF to get their little girl and so beautifully share their online journey to normalize and remove the stigma around life as a same-sex couple with children. After being Instagram friends and cheering each other on forever and a day, it's so beautiful to be sitting here with you both. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
No, amazing. We're so happy to have you on. So can you tell us a little bit about yourselves, your family, and where you both live to kick it off?
Yeah, so I'm Maddie. I'm 30 years old, a full-time firefighter, but currently off-road because breastfeeding is priority at the moment, so on the light duties. And yeah, I grew up on the Gold Coast, one of six kids, and yeah, I have my family up the East Coast here in Australia. So yeah, was raised up here, so very lucky.
Yeah, beautiful.
And I am Rochelle, the other half of this little duo. I'm 27, as you said, beautiful introduction. Thank you so much. I am a full-time paramedic in northern New South Wales. And yeah, I'm actually lucky enough to be off on leave at the moment looking after Macklin full-time while Maddie's back working full-time. And I grew up in the Blue Mountains in Sydney and moved up here for work and love it so much that I just decided to never leave.
Fair enough. And can you talk us through your journey of meeting each other, of falling in love and deciding, you know, you wanted to try for a baby?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess piggybacking on that, yeah, so I grew up down in Sydney and I actually got posted for my training location up on in northern New South Wales for work and didn't know anyone, kind of was really isolated up here and it was very foreign. This was like, you know, pre the world going a little bit crazy. So I was like, all right, well, I need to get out there and meet some people. And I actually joined an AFL team. I had never, ever played AFL in my entire life. I was a soccer girl through and through, so my hand-eye coordination is awful. But yeah, that's why I was like, where am I going to meet some people around my age that just like to have fun? And yeah, met Maddie. And then we kind of both had just gotten out of long-term relationships and, you know, weren't looking for anything at all. I was just starting my career and Maddie was really heavy into AFL at like a high level and stuff. So we were, and then I was leaving in 12 months' time. I was going back to Sydney to, you know, start work back down there after my training. And yeah, kind of things just progressed. And
we didn't take it seriously at the start because like I knew Rochelle was always being posted back and there's no way in hell I was moving to Sydney. And I was just like, I don't want my heart broken ever again. So I was just like, I think both of us had our walls up, but I think just it took its own course. And before we knew it, I was living in Sydney, chasing my dream job, living with Rochelle. So a bit of a plot twist there.
Love.
Yeah, it all kind of just like fell into place. Like I was going back to Sydney. Maddie was deciding whether to hang up the footy boots or not. And or has always wanted to be a firefighter, but she was playing footy so heavily that she couldn't kind of commit to a career like that. And yeah, applied, got in, started her training a couple of months after I got posted back to Sydney, and everything kind of just fell into place. But we always knew we wanted to move back to the Gold Coast because that's where we love it and where we wanted to raise a family. So yeah, moved back up here eventually because we were like, this is where we don't want to start a family in Sydney. We know this is not where we're going to be forever. And eventually got a job back up here, but that unfortunately meant that Maddie had to do fly in, fly out from Sydney because it's really hard to get a job as a firefighter in northern New South Wales. And there's not really that interstate changing with the government jobs. It's quite hard. So even it would be a little bit difficult for me to transfer to Queensland Ambulance. But once we got back here, our priority was kind of like, you know, following that white picket type of stuff. We were like, all right, we'll buy a house and then we'll start looking, like we'll get engaged and then we'll start looking at having a baby. So everything kind of happened really nicely for us, I think. And we did, we got engaged, we bought a house and then started talking about what our fertility journey would look like because we kind of knew it would probably take a little, like it might take a little bit of time.
Kind of just happened one thing after another. There was like, it was a bit too smooth. It was a bit weird how smooth it kind of all went for us.
So can you talk us through the fertility journey that you kind of touched on? How did you start navigating that? Did you know which one of you wanted to potentially carry Bubba? How did you go about the whole process and start the discussions? And yeah, super interested to hear about that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I suppose because of Maddie's work and her working in Sydney, there was kind of that, well, if I carry, then Maddie will be flying back and forth to Sydney while I'm pregnant, and what does that look like for us? So that was a really big discussion and really heavily influenced, I guess, our IVF journey and who was going to carry. And I actually didn't even really have a desire to carry initially when we were talking about our IVF journey. I was, you know, still in those early first 5-6 years of my career, and I was really trying to, like, you know, I was doing more study and I was progressing further. So I was not really at that stage where I was kind of wanting to carry and take that step back, whereas Maddie was definitely in that position. And it was just fortunate enough that her being pregnant also meant that she came off-road as a firefighter, which was a really hard decision to make, but they have a really good policy. Whereas as soon as you start going through IVF all the way until you finish breastfeeding, you actually can't be on the truck just because of all the
carcinogens,
the chemicals. And so they've got a really good policy in that, but it was really fortunate because it kind of worked in our favor if Maddie was to carry. So I think we were really fortunate in the fact that there wasn't a huge decision to make because it benefited if Maddie carried and she wanted to as well. I think the main decision for us was how we were going to go about it, because when we get married, hopefully at the end of the year, I'll be taking Maddie's surname. She was going to be the one carrying, and I kind of just felt really disconnected from the whole process after we started going through it. And I kind of brought that up to Maddie and said, you know, I don't know how I'm going to feel. Like, I don't know how to bond. I'm really struggling with this whole, like, you're carrying, it's your genetics, we're going to have your last name. And yeah, so then we have actually a few friends who have done what we did, which is reciprocal IVF. And so we started to have a look down that pathway and see if that was an option for us and, yeah, how we wanted to go about that, I suppose.
Do you want to explain a little bit what reciprocal IVF means? Because some people will be not really understanding what that all means.
So in a nutshell, it's basically Rochelle's eggs were collected, fertilized, and we were lucky enough to get one embryo. And then when it was timed with my cycle, then they transferred Rochelle's embryo into my body.
It's effectively almost like doing a donor cycle, but obviously in a same-sex couple where there's a family bond and a family unit, we call it reciprocal IVF, but where we collect eggs from one of the partners, inseminate them, and I presume it was with donor sperm. Did you know the donor, or is it an anonymous donor?
No, we went through an anonymous donor. So, yeah, that's another story that I'm sure we'll touch on. But, yeah, we ended up going through the fertility clinic with an anonymous donor.
So then we fertilize the eggs and then we place that embryo. And sometimes we can do it in a timed cycle so that we can actually coordinate the cycles between the two female reproductive organs so that we can actually time the egg collection and the subsequent transfer within a fresh cycle. Or alternatively, what we can do is create the embryos, freeze them, and at a point later we can time it with the menstrual cycle of the other partner so that we can place the embryo in their most appropriate time. So effectively what ends up happening is one partner's carrying the embryo created from the other person's egg, which is pretty cool.
Phenomenal.
And, you know, look, we've seen a lot of advancements in terms of fertility treatment in Australia, and largely that's got to do, and the thanks has got to do with a doctor down here in Melbourne called Professor John McBain. He actually took the Victorian government and the Catholic Church to court over. Well, in fact, he represented the woman who took the Catholic Church and the Victorian government to court, because at that point in time across Australia, a woman who was married, or a single woman. And a woman who'd sort of extricated herself from a relationship couldn't access donor sperm in order to achieve pregnancy. And so, in other words, women, same-sex couples, single women could not do fertility treatment. The only way a woman could do fertility treatment was if she was married to a man. That was the only way that it could happen. And we're only talking about 20-odd years ago. And so from the change in the Victorian legislation that then transpired to changes across the states and territories, to a point now where we can, you know, welcome couples irrespective of their sexual persuasion in order to allow them the opportunity to have children. And then even further, we've had advancements over the course of the last 2 years that have recognised the sanctity of a marriage between a woman and a woman and a man and a man, which has also then given rise to Medicare-funded cycles of IVF, which, you know, prior to 2 or 3 years ago, we'd have to do this completely unfunded through Medicare, because women who were in same-sex relationships weren't deemed to be infertile. So, you know, we've come a long way, this country, to a point now where we welcome all types of families. And so it's quite great that you guys are, you know, a product of all those humble beginnings down here in Melbourne, but, you know, now up in the Gold Coast with a beautiful little bubba.
Very beautifully said. But I absolutely agree. And I don't think that we realise the kind of what was before us, because we have so many friends who have gone through it in recent years that it was kind of just quite a normal thing for us.
But yeah, so it is, it's wonderful, isn't it? So that you're able to feel a lot more bonded and connected to a child that is, you know, you didn't carry, of course, but is genetically yours. And on Maddie's side, got to nurture that little bubba inside and then birth the baby. So there's that connection as well.
Yeah, so initially when we didn't plan to do reciprocal, but then the idea changed, I think this sense of connection blossomed between Rochelle and I, knowing the kind of connection that we had happening at the time. So I think I even looked at Rochelle differently in a more positive way, just because I was like, this is incredible. Like, genetically, I'm growing a tiny human that's going to have features like you. And for that, for me, in a relationship, I think that brought us really close. Mm.
And she looks like you, Rochelle.
Hey, can I just touch on why, I when I got married with my wife, and it's interesting because Italian women in Italy don't take on the surname of the male partner. And in actual fact, in Italy, kids can be named after their mum, surname. That never used to be happen. You always had to name the children the surname of the father. So there was a change in legislation a year ago in Italy. I when I got married with my wife, I said to my wife, I'd really love to change our name. So she was a Fitzpatrick and I'm a Scroy, and I wanted to make it Fitzroy. But with an I at the end. Like Fitzroy with an I at the end, right? She didn't want to do that. So I'm just putting it out there. I don't know what your surnames are, but think about mixing them.
Yeah, my surname's Lagozzo, so it's just a very hard surname to do anything.
Lagozzo, yeah. You can do something like that. What's yours, Maddie?
It's Roberts.
Oh, okay, fair enough. I'll come up with something by the end of the podcast.
Please right. Do. I'd love to hear our couple's right. Name.
Maybe Roberto or something. Did you say Roberto, maybe?
Yes, exactly. So what was, and we kind of briefly touched on the sperm donation side of things, but how did you go about that, and what was the process? What did that look like for you guys?
So we kind of always had in our head that we were going to use an anonymous donor. Mm-hmm. Again, very fortunate, just knowledge is power. We had spoken to a lot of friends about their process and just what everything looked like from a donor perspective through a fertility clinic. And then I was talking to one of my really good friends one day about it, who is in a heterosexual couple. And she just came out of nowhere and said, oh, my husband and I have been talking about it and we would really love to, you know, my husband would love to be a donor for you. And he was also one of our really good friends. And she said, look, I know that it can be really expensive, anonymous donor, or, you know, fertility in general. And she said, if that's an option, we would be happy to look into that for you. And it's quite a long and convoluted story, but we were going to go with that. You know, they were really good friends of ours and that was kind of looking like a potential option. But then it kind of just got a little bit too much for us and for him in the end. There's a whole legality side of everything and we didn't delve into that too much, but it was a lot of the emotional side that we were really struggling with. He kind of wanted to see what it would look like with him being involved in birthdays and Christmases, and then we were still kind of navigating that. But then he came to us probably a few weeks later and said, look, I can commit to one kid, but I don't know how my mental health and how emotions are, because he had a family of his own and kids of his own. I don't know what that's going to look like after one kid, so I don't want to commit to more than that. And we didn't really want our family being based on someone else's family, and if they wanted to travel or if they wanted to do whatever they wanted to do in the future, for us that didn't work as a couple and as a family. We wanted to do it on our own terms. And so, yeah, we scratched that idea and we ended up just going through an anonymous donor through the fertility clinic. And honestly, I think, I don't want to say we were lucky, but we had quite a good process and experience once so you essentially start your fertility treatments. We did a counseling session. And then after that, we got immediate access to the donor registry. And I've heard some people have to go on wait lists to wait until there's a spot available for the donor registry. I don't know if it was just good timing for us or if they don't do that in Queensland. I'm not too sure, but we kind of got access, you know, the second that we paid that fee. And it was kind of like a little bit of a weird situation. We did the same thing for picking the donor as we did for picking our obstetrician, actually. And we kind of had a look at all of the options and read their description and everything ourselves separately and picked kind of who we resonated with and what one we liked. And then we came back together, and for both our obstetrician and our donor, it was the exact same one that we had picked separately. Oh, so that was really cool.
That's amazing.
And really lucky. Yeah.
So much alignment.
Meant to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, I suppose for like the donor features,
what we share is olive skin and brown eyes. So I think a donor that had similar traits like that was a non-negotiable. But as for the rest, there wasn't anything that we're too worried about. I think
it was all kind of the standard stuff, like, you know, good medical history. Yeah. And we really liked the kind of characteristics of the donor, quite athletic and really good, like, so, just like, yeah, standard stuff, really.
And there's like frontline worker in their family. So like they had some sort of frontline work in their background as well. So it kind of felt like a bit connected in a way. It was a bit similar.
That's amazing.
You pick out the smallest little things just to kind of.
It is difficult, isn't it? But I mean, ultimately you want someone that's going to aspire to the same values that you do as a couple. Because, you know, absolutely, you're hoping that that'll transpire to what happens with your child. So it's difficult.
Yeah. And
I remember one of my mates who was going through fertility treatment, and I wasn't her doctor, but, you know, sitting down with all the different donors and trying to work out, you know, who's who and what's what.
Yeah, so we had 9 to choose from at the time we were choosing. And because this was our first time ever going through anything like this, we didn't really know what to expect. So we picked the one that we wanted and we called the fertility clinic and said, hey, you know, we're umming and ahhing about this particular one. Can we sit on it? And the lady was kind of like, they don't last long. You know, they get snapped up really quickly. And so that was, I guess, overwhelming for us because it's a huge decision to make, right? Like picking a donor. It's the other half genetics of your child. So having to make that decision kind of then and there was really big for us, but absolutely turned out to be the best thing ever. And we were really fortunate enough to get a few photos of the donor in the profile. Mm. And then we actually were able, this was a tip from our friend, we were able to reach out to the fertility clinic. It's an international donor, so over in America. And we gave them all of our details and they gave us even more information that our Australian clinic didn't have on the donor. So we got more photos. We got a handwritten note from him. Oh. We got like a staff impression from the donor clinic, yeah, about what their impression of him was. And so that was really nice for us to kind of get as much information as we could.
The Americans do it very well. And if I can do a little bit of a plug for donor, I mean, obviously I think, you know, the greatest gift you can give anyone is the gift of future life. And it seems to me that blokes, you know, in Australia, we're fortunate enough that we do have some donors. But here in Victoria, for example, the wait time can be up to 3 to 6 months. In other states and territories, a little bit differently. And that's partly because of altruistic donation. We can't pay someone to donate. And that's, you know, legislated federally in terms of organ donation. You can't pay someone for an organ donation. Same thing, you can't pay for someone to donate sperm. But equally so, donor eggs. You know, I think one of the things that many women don't realise is they can actually donate their eggs to a deserving woman and or couple that haven't got the opportunity to have children, partly because of age or maybe because they've entered into premature ovarian failure. And there's a lot of, I think, you know, we're very conscious that donor sperm is really important for same-sex and single women, but indeed donor eggs are really important as well. And that's starting to slowly kick up. And I think women can do a lot more for other women to support them during their fertility journey by donating eggs. So if you're out there listening and, you know, you've gone through a fertility journey yourself or alternatively you haven't, but you think, wow, you know, I didn't realize I can donate my eggs. Well, certainly go and see the fertility clinic and have a bit of a chat about donating your eggs to someone who's deserving as well. But all right, well, tell us a little bit about the embryo transfer day. That always seems to be the biggest thing, and somewhat weirdly, you're seeing the embryo on the screen. It's obviously your embryo, Rochelle, was going into Maddie. So how did that day go?
That was like a so surreal experience. Like when we first got in there, it just, with all the lead up appointments that we had and the length of them and the blood tests, and just felt like the appointments were endless. So when it came to the embryo transfer, it was like a 10-minute appointment. It felt like, and after it happened, I was like, what the? I was like, is this like for real? Like, is this how quick it is? Like, it just felt like a big lead up to something so almost simple in a way.
It's actually interesting you say that. I mean, I don't appreciate that. Yeah, it is. It's such a quick procedure, isn't it? And yet such a pivotal moment in the whole fertility journey. It's actually the most important thing, I think. You know, a lot of what happens in the laboratory is really important, but we also know that how the doctor transfers that embryo plays a huge role in terms of determining the outcome. And, you know, even in Melbourne IVF where I work, you can see vast differences between the top doctors' embryo transfer rates and the bottom embryo transfer rates. But, yeah, 10 minutes, it's in and out. It's quite quick, isn't it?
Yeah. I think ours probably would have been 7 minutes, but we have a funny story from that day, actually.
Yeah. But the nurse said, look, there's this small percent chance of this happening. It won't happen, don't worry, kind of blew it off. But about the embryo getting stuck when they did the transfer in, like, it's like a lengthy tube. Yeah. And she's like, it can get stuck. But she's like, we won't worry about that, it won't happen. And then, sure enough, they did the transfer. And then she looks back under the tube in the microscope and she's like, embryo. And then, like, we'd had our obstetrician had packed up basically and was ready to move on. And he was like, what? And I was like, of course it happened. Like,
it does happen very infrequently. And I always say to women as I'm doing it, we're just going to check the embryo because sometimes there's some static that keeps the embryo within the catheter and it doesn't come out. And it's very surprising, actually. I reckon those ones are the ones that want to latch into the uterus and just dig in there, and that's why they've latched into the side of the catheter and they want to dig in there too. So you need that second.
That's exactly what they said to us.
No, it's true. The few that I've had that have gone back in after another go, they've often ended up in pregnancy, so it's quite cool.
Yeah. It was a terrifying moment because after they did the second, flush in and checked, and she was like, the embryo's left the building, it's fine, and chucked the catheter in the sharps bin. And I was just staring at this sharps bin like, is my baby in the sharps bin?
Can I just say when they did that, the embryo's left the building, they go, uh-huh. No. See, you know why I do those sort of jokes. It's because I'm a dad. All right, so tell us about the first scan, because then there would have been the two-week wait and you would have ended up getting the positive pregnancy. Did you test beforehand or did you wait for the blood test?
100% we tested before.
At 3 or 4 days before or right from the get-go?
No, four days before.
And so you had the positive, pregnancy test, and that would have been how did you celebrate?
Well, it was kind of a because we saw, like, we tested on day four, it was the faintest line. Like, I'm talking, we had to back up to a window and break our necks and look sideways just to see this little faint line. So I think we did that day after day. So we kind of had a bit of excitement already, like, riveting in through our bodies. So when it came to, like, that's a definite line, it was, I think, it wasn't even jumping or anything. It was just, like, almost just a quiet, like, the best hug, like, excited, obviously, but the hug was just, like, just, I don't know, it was just this.
We made a baby hug.
This is happening. Yeah, this is going ahead.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those moments where it was just the best embrace that we could ever have had.
It's so special. This week's episode is brought to you by Bump and Bub, aka me. We have just launched our incredible new flavor of our motherhood hydration powder, Inux Berry. It was so highly requested and the feedback has been amazing. This nourishing, hydrating and energy boosting product now comes in two flavors, Blood Orange and Delicious Mixed Berry. Did you know your body prefers water that has plant-based compounds and electrolytes in it? As a result, your body will absorb water that includes our hydration powder more readily than plain water. The result? Better hydration for your sipping efforts. Our Motherhood Hydration Powder is a healthy way to hydrate your hard-working body. With the delicious taste of Australian Blood Orange or Mixed Berry coupled with the hydrating powers of coconut water, it will turn your drink bottle into your best friend. Completely natural, Australian-made, vegan, gluten-free, and oh so delicious. It's perfect for pregnancy, birth, breastfeeding, kid wrangling, but also hangovers, exercise, and for kids. Basically anyone that needs more hydration and a natural boost of energy. Created by an expert naturopath and midwife, we know that you will absolutely love this product. I, of course, want to give a sneaky discount for our beautiful podcast family. So use code HYDRATION15 for 15% off site-wide on bumpandbub.com or see the show notes below for more. And how was your pregnancy, Maddie?
I got really lucky, I think. I've got a mate currently pregnant and she's just got one more month to go and she's like, it's hard to see and it's crazy how different pregnancy journeys can be. Mm. But with mine, first trimester, I had some food aversion, went a bit funky on the food. Like, if I looked at a menu, like, I'll be fine, but if I looked at a menu and read food that I didn't feel like eating, I could go a bit green about it. But no, we stayed. I was able to feel healthy and buzzy enough to stay walking on a daily with Bub through the whole 9 months. So I was very fortunate that I didn't really have too many side effects. Had some random cravings. We're vegetarian, and I was craving Mongolian beef, and I had to turn the cricket channel off because KFC ads will pop up, and I'd want a Zinger burger. So, but yeah, first trimester was a bit chaotic with just being out of breath and been a bit off food, but the rest of the journey I was very, very fortunate to feel like I was a bit smooth and was able to go on my daily walks with.
Except for the fact that our hospital is like 40 minutes away and Maddie couldn't sit in the car for more than like 10 minutes without getting the worst reflux ever towards the end. So they ended up being very long car trips up. But if that's the worst thing that, you know, you can have.
Michelle, getting back to you, I mean, obviously one of the things that you'd said at the very start was this, you know, potential lack of connection. So how do you feel during the process of the pregnancy in terms of that connection now at this point, like, you know, heading up to birth?
Yeah, I think I really made a big effort to do things that I could do to help me feel connected and bonded. And so that looked like, for me, making sure that I was coming to every single appointment and making sure that I was really heavily involved in the nursery and setting up that and kind of little things that you could do, bonding with the baby and Maddie's belly, and just being there for her really helped me. I was so involved in helping her find the best, you know, maternity bras and clothes, and like being really heavily involved in all of the decision making, which I'm fortunate enough that Maddie was more than happy for me to, you know, be involved in and kind of almost take the reins on. She was like, yeah, go do the nursery, that's fine. So I think that really helped me, and I didn't struggle with a bond as much. I mean, I obviously didn't have that bond as much as a pregnant woman would. I couldn't feel the kicks, and I would go off to work for 12, 15 hours and kind of just not forget that we were growing a baby, but people would talk to me about it, but it wasn't that constant reminder because I wasn't the pregnant one. Mm. So I guess I kind of just floated through it. I never really had too many concerns about bonding. It wasn't until Macklin was here and I kind of started to feel a little bit helpless when she was upset and she just wanted Maddie, and I couldn't really help in those situations. So that was the hardest part for me, those early days when I was feeling really helpless. But the pregnancy, it was all just about being as involved as I can to help that connection for me.
I know that during my wife's pregnancy, I probably put on as much weight as she did. And that was an excuse.
Well, I'm lucky Maddie's a very active person, so all she wanted to do was just like walk and walk and walk. So she was walking faster than me by the end of it. The day before she gave birth, she was waddling along and I was trying to keep up.
Tell us a little bit about the birth. And I mean, it's you know, for me, obviously, you know, my wife and I had three kids and she's blonde hair, blue eyed. I knew these kids were going to come out sort of you know, brown haired or brown eyed at the very least. Yeah, she didn't get a sniff in. But, you know, obviously there's that anticipation. Tell us a little bit about the birth and then, you know, that first time that you saw Macklin in real life.
It took me a while to work out what actually happened, but I thought, because I'm quite an emotional person, and I was like, absolutely, I'll be crying. And when she was delivered and I saw her, I was crying, but there was no tears coming out because I had to fast the night before, and I was just so dehydrated. Like, I was crying, but no tears were coming out, and like it was the most special moment. But I think I was a bit more confused because, I mean, there was a lot happening in the room, and when I saw her and stuff, I was like, these emotions I was feeling, but like what my normal response would be with tears, I'm like, they weren't there. So then I got confused with what was happening a little bit. But once she was on the chest and I looked at Rochelle, and it was just the trio of us so, so close. And it was just finally, I think the anticipation got me really good the night before too. So just the relief of having her here, having us all happy and healthy at that moment was, you can't describe it unless you go through it, I don't think.
Yeah.
I think I was the opposite end. Like, I'm not that much of an emotional person. Well, I wasn't before I had a kid. It's different now. But I was like, oh, I didn't expect to cry. And as soon as she came out, because Mads had an elective cesarean, so I was able to be there through the whole thing, which was amazing. But as soon as she came out, I started crying. So that overwhelming feeling took me by surprise a lot, I think. And she was only kind of 2.7 kilos. So she was so little, and I just can't believe how like little and alien like these babies look like when they come out. I think that shocked me, and everyone in the room was more like, wow, she's such a tiny baby, more than, yeah, that was the biggest kind of spoken about thing in the room at the time.
Amazing. And what did that look like, that process straight after the C-section? Did Macklin stay on your chest, Maddie, or did you guys go to recovery together?
Yes, I was very fortunate that she was on my chest for hours. And she stayed on there, and yeah, basically how long was it? Probably about 4 hours, I think she was. And then straight off my chest onto Rochelle's chest when I needed that break. And one of the biggest things I was worried about with elective cesarean was, if I was nervous about anything, it was the spinal and getting that feeling back and my feet and everything. And by the time they wheeled us out to the recovery room with Macklin on my chest, I was already wiggling my toes. So like everything just felt so incredible at that time, because I was like, yes, I can move my feet, Macklin's on my chest, like all is good. So that was, I think, on the way out when I started getting those toe movements, I think that's when everything started feeling really like overwhelmingly, like just on track and just incredible.
Oh, this is such a beautiful overall story. It's such a beautiful story. And I don't want to shift it to the negative, but I think it's also important to just chat about, because I've, you know, I've seen or I've heard on your podcast, shout out to your beautiful podcast as well. you know, you've talked, Rochelle, about feeling, I know in your last episode, feeling like sometimes it's difficult in the, you know, just even when you're out and about and being assumed that you're not both Macklin's mums and maybe you're, you know, where's your partner or who's the baby's father and those kind of comments or things like that, and how that impacts you guys as a family and as individuals, and you know, the role that you both play as her mums. Can you chat a little bit about that?
I think we were very fortunate at the hospital that we went to, because they are attached to a fertility clinic, and we personally know, so I can only imagine how many same-sex couples have come through those doors. So the hospital situation was incredible, but yeah, absolutely, the outside type of, unless we're walking down holding hands in public, you know, when Maddie was pregnant, it was a lot of the conversation was directed towards Maddie, and there was no assumption, which I completely understand, and we never expect there to be an assumption that we're together. I think we just like to kind of put out there that you don't have to assume that we're together, but just don't assume that we're not together. Don't assume that we're straight, like kind of just, we like people to look at saying partner instead of assuming that we have husbands. And yeah, so there were a few times, like for example, Maddie would call up to make an appointment and the lady on the phone said, oh, you know, don't worry about bringing your husband. This is going to be quite a long appointment. He'll get quite bored. And Maddie.
What a comment, even if you did have a husband. Like,
yes, seriously.
Right? And that's our point. Like that was our thought exactly. Maddie was like, okay, one, don't assume that I'm straight and have a husband. And two, of course, if I did have a husband, he would be coming along to the appointment. Like he's just as involved in this as I am, kind of thing. So little stuff like that, which, you know, we get, and there's no malice in it whatsoever. I think one thing for me, and I have brought it up quite a lot because it was quite a hurtful moment for me, was when we went to one of Macklin's postpartum checkups, and I had booked the appointment because it was at the hospital near where I work. So my name was kind of just on the file. And when we left the appointment, the nurse kind of called out in front of the whole waiting room and said, oh, can you just make sure to take Rochelle off as the mum on Macklin's file and put Maddie down as the mum and just put Rochelle as the other parent, because Maddie's the one that's breastfeeding and gave birth. And I get it from a medical, you know, data perspective, but it was just in front of a whole waiting room. It was probably a conversation that could have been had, you know, with the receptionist privately. And then I just felt like everyone was kind of looking at us being like, oh, that, you know, what's happening? And so little moments like that are still hard, and there's still kind of a long way to go in that sense. But yeah, overall, we have been really fortunate in we've got a lot of supportive friends and family. And yeah.
At the end of the day, like we know that no matter what, we're going to still like, we're going to have this all the time. We're not expecting people to, like Rochelle said, assume that we are gay or anything like that. I think it's just, yeah, just saying partner instead. But, I don't know. It's not something that we're expecting to change, and it's always going to, like, we encountered someone in a lift even, and I nearly got my hand stuck in the lift with Macklin in my hand, and he's like, we're walking in together in, like, this clinic, and this night, like he was a nice worker. He was in the lift with us. He's like, oh, you're going to go home and tell daddy that mum got your hand stuck in the lift type thing. And it's just when he left out, I looked at Rochelle and said, it's just a nice person having a conversation, but like it's just not in someone's forefront of their mind, especially if they're not around same-sex couples in their day-to-day life as well.
It's a reflection really of just, society at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's like it's nothing malicious. It's just how it is, and we accept that. That's okay. But yeah,
what's Macklin going to call each one of you?
So at the moment, I'm Mum, and Maddie's Mumsy, but we don't know. We kind of think that she will just decide. Yeah. Like she started kind of saying like Mumma, so Maddie is kind of like, well, maybe I should be that. But I think she will eventually make her own names for us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about what's going to happen second time around, because you did talk about the possibility of having another child. So are we going to go reciprocal the other way? Is that the plan, or what are you guys thinking?
Our options are like endless at the moment, but
so limited at the same time.
So with my situation with work, it still suits better that I carry as again for the second one. We were originally saying IUI with me as well, but at the same time, I'm still breastfeeding and haven't got my cycle back yet either. So I have that kind of pressure to make a decision whether to ease up breastfeeding so I can get my cycle and then go through the process.
How old's Bubba at the moment?
She's almost 10 months.
Yeah, not going to give you fertility advice because I can't. Because at the end of this podcast, you'll know that this podcast is not deemed for medical advice. But in actual fact, you can conceive while breastfeeding. And some doctors are a little bit hesitant to give medication that potentially helps stimulate ovulation and therefore you can become pregnant. I mean, obviously, you've got to go through and understand the risks and the benefits of the medication and what impact that may have on breast milk supply and also on yourself personally and also on the baby. But you know, I've had a patient of mine who pretty much has had three children and has breastfed through all pregnancies, she was breastfeeding all the way through her second pregnancy with her first child, and then was breastfeeding both the children together, weaned one, got pregnant again, then had the second and the third breastfeeding at the same time when they were born. So it can be done. It's just a matter of speaking to your specialist about whether they're happy and comfortable, and certainly you're happy and comfortable doing it as well.
Yeah, that's it. It's hard to make those decisions and be confident with just even like the small, like they say, this could be a result of this. We're just trying to keep things as clean and as straightforward as possible. So with me, like in this situation of easing breastfeeding being the possibility to go to start another journey with a little bub. I think I don't want that to happen again because Rochelle has this desire to carry as well. So, look, it's looking like we're going to be having three kids if I have the second one, if we're lucky. So I think I'd like to go through IVF and have my eggs collected and fertilized and hopefully make some embryos as well to put aside. So if I do carry the second one, whether it's through IVF and my own egg this time, or IUI, I just have those embryos on the side as well. So if it comes to the third bub and Rochelle's planning on carrying, that she has that option to either carry her own embryo or my embryo as well. And if I'm still breastfeeding at the time, I don't have that pressure kind of to go through the IVF process as well. So just breastfeed for as long as I want, not have that pressure that I'm feeling at the moment to either ease sooner than I want to or, yeah.
You guys are amazing. I'm dodging conversations about next children like no tomorrow. And Zadie's 2 months older than Macklin and I'm just holy moly.
Well, we kind of feel like we're in the thick of it already and we don't want her to get to like 18 months, 2 years and be like a complete nightmare and we just like avoid all kids. So we're like, while we want to do it now, we should take that opportunity in that window. But yeah, just piggybacking off what Maddie said, I actually do now have a desire to carry. So it's been a really hard conversation for us because I would love to carry the second. But what that looks like for us as a family is me pregnant with a toddler and Maddie working in Sydney while we live on the Gold Coast. And that's a lot for our family mentally, emotionally, financially. And as well, I had a bit of a tough time with my egg retrieval and I only got four eggs, and only one fertilized on day one. And so that one became an embryo and was Macklin, which was amazing. But they kind of have said to me, if I was to go through IVF again, I would probably want me to go through ICSI, which Dr. Joe would probably explain it way better than me, but I believe that's where they inject the sperm directly into the egg when, you know, IVF is not successful or you're not having much success with IVF. So my fertility journey might look a little bit harder as well when I was to carry.
Mm. Interesting. And how does it look as a paramedic if you were pregnant, Rochelle?
Oh, As long as you can lift a patient, they'll make you work. No, yeah, they are really good. If you are having any issues, you can go off-road on alternative duties. But essentially the idea is if you're fit to work and you're feeling okay, then you kind of work until you don't feel comfortable anymore. I think with the change of the world and everything at the moment, you know, with COVID and the new precautions and everything, there are a lot more pregnant women who are going off-road a lot earlier, just for their own personal preference. But yeah, that's what that essentially would look like. I would work until I don't feel comfortable anymore and then go off on alternate duties. So that's kind of easy in the sense, like, that's, we're very lucky to be in government jobs and have those options available to us.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing so much of your journey with us. And I mean, I follow you online. So where can everyone else who wants to continue following your journey and these future beautiful babies, where can they find you? And also tell us a quick bit about your podcast, because the intro is phenomenal. I mean, obviously the whole podcast is great, but the intro is out of this world. I want to redo ours after listening to yours.
Yeah, we're coffee fanatics. We're obsessed with it. I think Shift Work has really drilled that into us. But yeah, the intro to our podcast is a coffee machine and it always makes us want coffee. But thank you so much. Our podcast is Those Two Mums, and we basically normalize and talk about conversations that we feel like aren't spoken about enough. So things similar to yourself, but less technical and educational, because you two are incredible. But we normalize IVF journeys and same-sex couples and parenting and just relationships, absolutely everything that are still taboo topics that people, you know, should talk about more. And then, yeah, on our Instagram, which is those.2mums, we kind of do a similar thing. We normalize our life as a same-sex couple, and we're just like everyone else, and we like to be that representation that we didn't have growing up. So that's what we aim to do, and we're absolutely loving every minute of it. And then we get to do special interviews like this with you too.
Amazing. So good. Well, thank you again, and yeah, we can't wait to keep following along on your journey.
Amazing. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Baby Baking and Kid Raising. If you'd like to suggest a guest or connect and see more of us, then head to Instagram at Baby Baking and Kid Raising. And if you enjoyed this episode, we'd be so grateful if you could hit subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever listening platform you use. Please note that the information provided in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of a qualified healthcare provider regarding your own pregnancy, birth, and health conditions.